as I said before, this is the fourth segment for Making Joyful Adults. In my book and when I do my presentations, I talk about how I'm not making perfect children, how there's no such thing, but how I am instead making joyful adults who know what their mission in life is and can't wait to fight for it and have a solid relationship with God and family. And so the things that we've talked about so far, the three characteristics before today, we've talked about confidence, about direction, purpose, and then today we're going to be talking about relationships. Next week will be the very last week that we talk about the five characteristics for a joyful adult, because it will be characteristic number five, of course. So every single Friday, we do Field Trip Friday at our house. And actually, in the summer, we do field trip days a lot. I feel like summers are for outings, and we just go and do outings all of the time. In fact, yesterday, we did a really fun outing. If anybody lives in Utah, it is so fun to go up to the Utah Olympic Park that's in Park City. If you've never been up there, it was our first time to visit up there. And to watch the ski jumpers come down and jump and land in the big swimming pool, and to watch the summer bobsledders, and it's just so neat to see those winter sports being done all year round. Anyway, my children were enthralled. We had a wonderful time hiking around the mountain and in the museum, and it was just all kinds of fun. So, you know, if you've never seen that, go to it. It's free. It was all kinds of fun. Anyway, but these days where we go on outings, when we do Field Trip Fridays, because I try to make sure that throughout the year we're having at least one family field trip day a week, these are super high priorities for me. And I don't ever schedule anything on those days. And the reason that they're so important is because they are relationship-making days. We experience things together, we discuss, we laugh and joke, and we make inside jokes, and we become inspired together. It's just a beautiful thing. It creates so much conversation because we're experiencing things as a family. And, you know, one thing I've found is sometimes we go on our field trip days with friends, and sometimes we go on camping trips and things with friends, but usually the most memorable of these outings, these field trip things, these times where we're making a lot of memories and getting inspired, the most memorable are usually the ones we just did, just us, without anybody else. And it's not that the other people are a problem, but it's that instead the children will bond with their friends and create the relationship moments with them more instead of creating them with me. So no matter what other things I have to do on a Friday, I always put them on hold and just relax with my children and go and see things and talk and create memories. Now, a person doesn't have to have a field trip Friday to have good relationships, though. There are some other things that we can do to make every moment relationship-building moments. Remember that being a parent is the greatest of all missions. I don't know if you remember in the book where I talk about the eight different missions that people often have in their lives. And then I talk about how being a parent is all eight of those missions. So every single one of them goes into being a parent. If we live with purpose in that mission, in that parent mission, we show our children something special. We show them where happiness comes from, and we show them what real family relationships are about. Mission, actually, is not necessarily a thing. It's not being a mom or a dad or a doctor or a philanthropist. That's not actually the mission. That's not what mission really is. Mission is an attitude that you have. It's a way that you see it's the way that you see how you live and see the task at hand. It's the way you feel and the way that others feel when they're around you while you're living with purpose. So keep that in mind as we think about the greatest mission today, and that is being a parent, and what that really means. It doesn't mean a list of tasks, even though, of course, we all know there's tons of them, right? There's all kinds of things that we have to do all the time. But we can get so caught up in that that we can forget what mission really is, and that's our attitude and the way that we are living, the way that we are connecting with other people. If we just do all of the tasks, we might miss the mark, and then the relationships suffer. So I want to talk with you today about three things that you can do to improve your relationship with your child. Number one is example. Of course, we are the greatest example to our children, and that's not any news to anybody, right? But what we don't often remember is that our relationships with other people and the way that we nurture our relationships with other people, such as our spouses, maybe other extended family members or friends, are actually the examples for our children and how they're going to have relationships with us. So if we give and serve our spouse and we don't complain about them and we have a really good relationship there, then our children are going to see that and go, oh, so that's how it is. You know, that's how relationships are supposed to be. So right now, I'm arguing with Mom all the time, but that's not actually the kind of relationship that she wants to have with me. She wants to have this other kind of relationship. But if we do other things, if we become grumpy, if we become offended all the time, if we have an attitude problem about so many other relationships, well, number one, it's going to be hard to maintain then a different attitude when we're with our children because we are with them all the time. And so to switch over like that would be kind of difficult for most people. But the other thing is they're going to go, oh, well, actually, as time goes by, this is the kind of relationship I'm going to have with my mom because this is the kind of relationships that she has with other people. Or same thing with my dad. This is the kind of, you know, friend he is to other people. Or this is the way he treats people. So, you know, he's probably faking it with me right now. In fact, when I did foster care, a number of the children really did think at first that surely if I cared about them and I was talking with them and spending time with them and that I was really, you know, acting sincere or being sincere, that it must be just that, an act. That it was some sort of manipulation to try and get them to change. That it really wasn't sincere. And the only thing I could do to show them that it was sincere was just maintain constant in all of my relationships. If all of a sudden I started talking bad about my friends or my family or my spouse or something like that behind their backs, then they would know I wasn't consistent. But if they saw me in my other relationships being the same way, then they would know that that really was what a relationship was supposed to be like, and I was offering that to them, and that they got to choose if that was going to be the relationship that they were going to have. So gossip is a big deal. Gossip is one of those things that I think almost every single person comes in contact with and has to choose what to do with because it's just so prevalent. It's everywhere. And it's because we all have feelings, that's why, and we all have pride. And so the two things together create gossip. So we get our feelings hurt or we feel somehow, you know, inferior, superior, whatever it is, to another person or a group of people or something like that. And we just can't help but discuss it because when we discuss it, it strokes our pride. And so those two things together create gossip. And gossip destroys relationships. Even if the person's not there, even if they have no idea and they don't know about it, it destroys the relationship at the very least for the person who is saying something, who's talking in a gossip type way. So in our family standard, we made an amendment to it a number of years ago, and we added in there that we will not gossip. Well, on the BBC show, that part of the family standard is read when we're sitting at the counter with James and Hannah. And there was a gentleman who lived in England, who has since become a dear friend of mine. And he asked me one day, he said, how come gossip, you know, how come that's a big thing? And you said that on the show, like, we will not gossip about people. Why is that such a big deal? And so I shared with him the very thing that I just shared with you, how gossip destroys relationships, and how, even though you're not gossiping, like, let's say I'm not gossiping about my spouse, but if I gossip about my neighbor, even if it's not even to my spouse, to another neighbor, it actually affects my relationship with my spouse. Somehow I'm just not as sincere, and I'm a little bit more selfish anyway. But gossip always is one of those things that turns your attention toward yourself in a way that is not productive and separates you from many other people. Anyway, so I shared with him about gossip and why we cared about that and how we knew it destroyed relationships. And he just said, huh, you know, people do that all the time. He said, I don't know if I even really know people, you know, that don't gossip. And he was really surprised. He said, you know, I'm going to work on that one. And it was a really interesting thing to see him have this sort of revelation about gossip. So, and at first when they did the BBC show, I thought, why did they put that part in there? But maybe they did think that was an interesting thing to bring up, and so they put it in there too. So anyway, it is really important for teaching children to have positive relationships with people, not to gossip, and it keeps parents from slipping into bad behaviors too, really. That's why we made the amendment, not because our children were having problems with gossiping, but actually because the parents, me and my husband, would have more of a tendency to slip into a gossiping situation where, you know, somebody, some neighbor did something to one of the children or just, you know, was whatever, and that we would feel disgruntled somehow, or we would feel, you know, offended or, you know, superior, whatever it was, these little feelings that come, and we would start talking about it. And we realized we were even talking about it in front of the children, which is truly one of the worst things that you can do, because then what does that train them? They want to get in on it because it seems so juicy and so good. And we had a moment when we were observing our oldest son repeat back something that happened to have been said between my husband and I, sort of as a, almost in jest. It was like, we were kind of making fun of somebody. It was almost kind of like a joke. Years ago, and he wasn't very big, and when we heard him say something that was almost exactly like we said to one of his friends when we just happened to be around, we both sort of looked at each other and went, oh no, we have been bad examples. This is not good. And so we decided that we had to make sure that gossip was not part of our family, that we would not do that anymore, especially with the kids around, but really that we would just try to for sure not do it. So that's why we put it in the whole family standard. Okay, the second thing that I want to share with you about improving relationships is nurturing. Now, I know that generally when you speak of nurturing, you think of mothers and the role that mothers have with their children, and obviously that's true. I mean, there's a lot of nurturing that goes on there with the mothers. But fathers also nurture, and they have their own way of nurturing, and they have their own tone that they can have with nurturing as well. And even though you could describe it the same as women's, you could say trusting tone or something like that, or a loving tone, it still feels different than a woman's tone feels. But both of those kinds of nurturing are so important. The father nurturing and the mother nurturing are so important for children to grow up to be those joyful adults. They need to see that difference. Also, they're going to connect with you in a certain way. in a way that they have learned from the nurturing over the years. And so the way that you nurture them, the way that you interact with them when they are 6 years old is somewhat the same way you're going to interact with them when they're older, when they're maybe even gone from your house. You're going to talk to them somewhat the same, except for you're not going to say, don't go out in the road, and no, you can't have a snack. I mean, you're not going to parent them in that way, but your communications with them, your bond with them, will feel somewhat the same. With my mom and dad, there are certain things, there's kind of a bond that I have with them that I've had for as long as I can remember, and it feels a certain way. And there's a certain way that I ask them for help. It's not whiny or anything like that. It's not like a little kid would do. But it's just a way that I communicate with them that is different. It's more honest. It's more, I don't know, just open, I guess, than it is with most of the other people in my life, except for maybe my spouse and children. But there's an openness there, a familiarity, and a, it's just almost like a relationship grooming that happened from that nurturing, and they still nurture me in so many different ways. You never stop nurturing your children. It just happens forever and ever. Just like your husband and wife, your spouse relationship, you nurture each other as well. So anyway, nurturing is very important, and there's a certain tone that goes with nurturing. I mentioned trust already. Trust is really important. That trusting in the goodness of the other person, in that child, it makes you more approachable. It makes you more safe. When they sense that you trust them, then your relationship can go somewhere. Now, I know that this is so difficult when, say, you have a child that has honesty issues or something like that. Because when somebody is being dishonest and you can't trust them, then it's really hard to determine, well, how can I act like I trust them or seem like I trust them when I can't trust them, when they're having problems being dishonest or something like that? The trust isn't in everything they say and do. It's a different kind of trust. It's a trust in the goodness of the person, that you know that person really, truly, inside does desire good things. Even if they seem like selfish desires sometimes, these good things for themselves, still, they do want good, and that's their initial motivation for everything that they're doing with their decisions. So we trust in that. I told myself one way that I was able to maintain this trusting, approachable, safe tone is I told myself something when I was doing foster care. When I was doing foster care, there would be so many weird things that would happen. And I told myself at the very beginning, and I don't remember why exactly. I think it was because the very first foster child that we had some really severe issues. Oh, yes, because she, at the very beginning, like day one, it was like lie, steal, you know, all this kind of stuff, and things that you would normally go, are you kidding me? Why would you even think there's a benefit from telling that lie or from taking that thing? I mean, why would, you know, it would be things that would just make you go, the person is, you know, I could start judging them, right? And because I would become so shocked at what they had done. And so I decided early on, nothing shocks me. I just made a decision. This was a really helpful affirmation, and I would say it to myself usually a couple of times a day, not even planning it. You know, some affirmations you plan to say, but what would happen is I would look at the day and I'd go, I wonder what's going to happen today. And then I would say, no matter, nothing shocks me. And the cool thing was it worked. I really wasn't shocked then. Because I had already told myself that day, nothing shocks me. It doesn't matter what it is, it doesn't shock me. And then as time went on, I probably didn't tell it to myself every day. But I remember specific moments when I would find out about behaviors with some of my foster children. And the first thought that would pop into my head, because I had thought it so often, was, nothing shocks you, Nicolene. So then I would not be shocked. and I would just very calmly and rationally, logically handle the situation with the child, and it was so much more effective. And the children would find that even though they made a few mistakes, they couldn't help but want to come and talk to me and tell me stuff, because I never became irrational, emotional, or upset about something that had happened. Because when you get shocked, it's because you're usually emotionally involved in a situation. And I know that with foster children, it's a little bit easier not to be emotionally involved, because they're not actually yours for the long term. And you usually know that. And so sometimes, you know, if something would normally be disappointing to you, it's a teeny bit easier with foster children not to be as disappointed. But I've got to say that even with my own children, I have noticed there have been these moments when I feel like my initial feeling is, oh, wow, did they really just do that? And then I go, you know what? Nothing shocks me. This is okay. We'll just talk about it. It's like an instant reaction. And this is part of my nurturing, which keeps me safe so that they will always feel open to talk to me. If you can be safe during a time when a person is having a problem or has done something wrong, they know you're always safe. And that's a beautiful relationship building aspect to have. If I were to react to their behaviors or situations, then I would automatically be putting up a wall between us. And when I choose not to be reactive and not to be shocked or emotional or disappointed in something, then actually I'm building a bridge. I'm helping them cross a hard thing instead of making a separation or a division so that they're stuck on one side and I'm on the other. And that also, when you make walls like that, it just fosters so much dishonesty too. I see it happen all of the time. When a parent builds a wall because of their emotional attachment to whatever thing happened or a word that was said or something like that, then the child automatically gets reactive too. And their first thing that they do when they become reactive is usually start to lie. And then when they lie, then your wall becomes taller and more thick, and your ability to have a relationship with them diminishes significantly. The nice thing about this is that it can change if you haven't done it right in the past. If you've made walls because you've become emotional or, you know, really disappointed or shocked or some of these words that I've been saying, you actually can very easily fix it just by choosing, I'm not going to be that way anymore. I'm going to explain that to them that that's okay, and, you know, let's talk about what we should do, and I'm going to be a little bit more safe. You can make a change, and you can do a few things to make an effort. I know that there are a lot of families, because I've had private mentoring calls with a number of them that have that very problem when they are very disconnected from some of their children. And so, you know, it can change. It does take a bit of time, especially if the child is, say, 17 or 18 and you have a major disconnection that's been going on for a number of years and you're not honest in your relationship. That child's been groomed pretty good to see you in a certain way. It will take some effort and some time to change, but it can change. And I'm actually living proof of that. I was very disconnected from my parents. In fact, for a time in my upbringing, when I was younger, I actually had, you know, I was lying to them all the time. And I really looked at them as the enemy in my life, even though, you know, they weren't even bad. They weren't even doing anything. I had just chosen a disconnection. And it was because of some of the reactions, the emotional reactions that they had had, maybe a few things that I'd done. I just felt like, well, I can't trust them, so they don't get to be a part of my life. And I remember consciously thinking that. And then I hit a beautiful age. I hit about age 14, and I met this girl. She was a good friend of mine. In fact, became my best friend. I just love her dearly. And she had a relationship with her family and with her mother that was so different. Her mom was so calm and almost, I mean, I don't know, almost just so opposite in a lot of ways from what my family was. And we would go to her house, and she would tell her mom all kinds of stuff. Oh, this boy, and he's so cute, and da-da-da-da. And I'd be standing there with her, and I'd be talking to her mom and telling her stuff. And I went, wow, look at this relationship she's got with her mother. This is amazing. And so I decided on my end of my parent relationship that I was going to make a change. One of the changes I've already spoken about before on other calls and in other articles about how I, you know, decided that I was going to follow instructions and pretty much show them some more respect. That was a different part of the same exact time in my life when I was like 14 years old. But also another thing that I did is I consciously decided I want my parents in on my life. This feels cool with this friend of mine, and I don't have this because I have pretty much shut them out. And so I all of a sudden just started talking to them more about all kinds of stuff. And the cool thing that happened is that my parents, I think, glimpsed what I was doing. Either that or they liked it too. And so, or maybe they were trying the same thing at the same time. They very well could have been. I don't know their side of this story. I should talk to them about it. But something magically happened around age 14. Toward the latter year, I was, you know, the end of my 14th year, I was almost 15. And they changed the relationship with me, and I did my side of it too. And then we became these absolute amazing friends that supported each other through everything. Now, they were still my parents. But the cool thing was, is I really did want to respect them. I saw no other way to have happiness than to respect them. And they saw no other way to keep the relationship good with me except for to, you know, be safe and approachable as well. So we made a huge change, and it was worth it. And I was 14. So I know that it can happen with other people too, but I also know it takes some effort, and sometimes it's one-sided for a while. It may be mom and dad that make the change, but just have faith that it'll work and that you're doing the right thing. I sort of see myself as going side by side with my children when they've made a mistake, instead of in front or behind. Like, as a leader in my family, I don't see myself as pulling my child or as pushing my child, but instead as walking side by side with my child, helping pull them through whatever the problem is. And saying, hey, let's go this way or let's go that way, but very much this joint thing where we go at it together, and I don't see them as ahead of me or behind me in some way. I'm the nurturer. This means I'm the guide, and a guide stays close and talks through each step. A guide trusts the person they're guiding while pointing them in the right direction. So nurturing is number two. And number three is communication. Now, communication's huge. There's so many different ways that communication happens. There's a verbal communication when we actually talk to each other and we, you know, express our feelings of, you know, whatever they are, our emotions, logic, all kinds of things are communicated verbally with people. That's where we can, you know, really tell them how we care about them, or we can spend time talking to them, which then shows them how we care about them and shows many things. But even more than verbal, there's lots of the nonverbal ways. Now, written is another way. Written is still a type of verbal communication because it's still with words, even though it's written on a piece of paper. However, when a person gets verbal communication in a written format, then that person gets a little bit of a luxury. The luxury is, number one, they get to keep the words. But The second luxury is they get to ponder on the words much longer than a person who hears the words just verbally out of someone's mouth. So when something is written down, all of a sudden it becomes a little bit more personal, a little bit more emotional. There's some feeling that can be scripted in written words just perfectly. And I do think there is a beautiful thing with writing to your children. My children this last week went on a trek activity with another group of youth where they were all trekking through the Wyoming desert with a group of like 300 youth. It was a really neat experience for them to have, kind of like a, you go through some hardships, you know, and you learn a lot from it. It was a really neat thing, an experience that they call trek. Anyway, but they were on this trek, and the organizers of the event had all of the parents write letters to the children so that when they were out there on this trek and going through all of these hard things, that they would read letters of encouragement and love and support from their families. And I thought that was just genius that they understood the beauty of the written verbal communication. Written is the only kind of communication that you can have with a person when you're not actually there with them. You can do verbal over the phone, but when your presence, like they have no contact with you, written is something they can take with them forever. It can get sent to them, and they can get it when you are not actually available to them. And it's a treasure for them. My husband wrote some beautiful letters to my children for their trek activity, and I was talking to my daughter about the things that were written in the letters, you know, and she said, yeah, Dad said this and this, and it was just a beautiful thing for them to have this letter always to keep, and she's the kind of person who will keep it, and she was really grateful to have had it. When we had the British teens in our home, the BBC had their parents also do the same, write them a letter, and they read those letters while they were in our home, and both of those youth became very emotional when they read the letters from their families, because they realized they saw themselves different. When they were removed from their family and then heard the verbal words from their parents, all of a sudden it made a difference. They weren't right there in the moment. They were having a different experience. Then they saw their lives, their relationship in retrospect, instead of in the moment, and they were able to appreciate it and make goals toward it. So it was a really smart thing that they do as part of the World's Strictest Parents show. So verbal communication, written communication, I have is separate. Then there's also physical communication, where you actually touch a person. And that physical kind of communication is really important for all people. If we don't get those physical touches from time to time, we start to feel very isolated, disconnected. A lot of people end up having emotional issues if they don't have a good, strong physical connection with other people. So as much as some people don't like to touch that much, they don't like their children to hang on them or whatever. I mean, I've been there. I was in the swimming pool yesterday, and I had people climbing all over me. And then I was eating dinner the night before, and Porter thought it would be so funny to, like, play with my hat and mess up my hair. And we were just having so much fun. And I really got to a point where I had to tell him, okay, that's enough, you know. I've had enough touch for now. But he was loving it. He was loving to be able to just touch me and just be part of me, you know, like he was when he was a baby. And it's important. It really is. My oldest son, his love language is touch, and he always comes up to me and just will kind of give me a little shoulder rub, or, you know, just kind of give me a little squeeze. put his arm around me, and it makes him feel good to put his arm around me. And not only do I allow, when I allow him to do that kind of touch to me, I'm saying, I want a relationship with you. I can tell you love me. I'm communicating to him just by allowing him to communicate his love language to me. So, you know, physical is really important. Then the other kind of non-verbal communication that there is there's feeling. The way that we actually feel. Now, some people may call it your aura, your spirit, your, I don't know. There's different terms that people use for the way that a person feels. But that feeling that we communicate to another person, and I really do believe that it's a spiritual type of communication. It's where the inside of you actually, you know, connects and communicates with the inside of somebody else. I had a situation, there's a world-renowned speaker and author who is, he's absolutely so in demand that there's no way you could hardly ever get a moment with him. Well, I happened to have literally, I don't know, 30 seconds with him one time because I went to a book signing. And I don't usually go to book signings because you have to wait in big, long lines and, you know, I just don't. But this one particular one, I thought, I want to get this signed for my dad for his birthday because this is an author my father just loves and he's doing great things for the world. Anyway, so I went to the book signing and I waited in this line like blocks down the street of Salt Lake City to go to this book signing. And when I got up to the little teeny table where he was standing there signing books, there was a thing that happened. I mentioned something to him, a shared experience we had had a few years prior to that. And he looked at me, and I just shared with him really quickly, you know, I don't know if you remember this experience, I was there too. I just want you to know something happened because of your involvement in that experience. And I just told him what had happened. And he looked at me in such a deep way. It was really amazing what happened. The inside of me and the inside of him had a very profound connection. More profound than any casual greeting that I've really ever had. And I had to just walk away. There were people behind me, and they push you through like you cannot believe, like boom, 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 push you through. And he kept looking at me, and I just looked at him, and there was words that were shared. I felt him say, I wish we could talk about this. This is very interesting to me, but I can't. You know, and I knew that, and my words back were, I understand, I just wanted you to know. But we didn't even share those words. They were just communicated by the way we felt when we were right by each other and when we happened to look at each other as I was walking away. I don't know if any of you have ever had experiences like this, but I've had them from time to time, not in such a profound way necessarily, but times where I know I feel things from other people, and I just act on those feelings. And usually 9 times out of 10, you know, that was really what needed to happen. And I was paying attention to that feeling really well. So that's another way that we communicate with people. But that also means that the way we feel, if we're frustrated, if we're down, if we're feeling selfish, if we're feeling tired, if we're, you know, all the things, all the feelings that we have, those actually transmit then to all the people around us, which means that they can destroy our relationship. So all these different ways that we communicate, verbally, written, physically, or with feeling, which is probably, to be quite honest, the number one most powerful way to communicate, and the way that is communicated most often. We feel something from someone, like we feel, I can't trust you, or we feel, wait a minute, you just said that, but I don't know if I believe you, and because just the way you did that, or just I just feel that's not right. Whatever it is, that way is the most popular way to communicate, because it happens all the time. We can't stop it, really, from happening. But all of these different ways of communicating either strengthen or weaken our relationships with our children. And so when I talk in my seminars and in my book about the tone that we have, that's the feeling. And when I talk about the verbal, you know, when I talk about correcting and praising and stuff like that, that's all verbal communication. But keep in mind, like, the physical. And I know in some classes I mention it, like, if you hold your body in a certain way, your body language communicates. It's a physical communication to another person of how you're feeling. But keep in mind that those other communication styles, written and physical communication, might be helpful to be added into your relationships as well. We use all these different kinds of ways to communicate, so you can't ever, you know, overdo one or the other. When I think of communication with my children, the first thing that comes to mind is talk, and talking a lot. Our lives are so busy in society nowadays that just having time to talk is an incredible luxury. There are days that go by where I don't feel like I really truly have talked with my husband. I mean, we see each other, we have dinner together, we're doing projects and things, we're doing stuff with the children, but we haven't really just talked for a couple of days. And it is a strange feeling that happens when you have times like that. And in our society, they happen pretty easily and quickly because we're so busy. So try to make sure that you get those opportunities to talk. That's why the mentor sessions with the children are so vital. You need to have those meetings where you plan together, you talk about things, and you figure out ways to plan for the better. Also, when you're talking to your children, be real. Don't just be an advice giver or somebody who's always the opposite of what they are, but really, truly seek to understand. If you can seek to understand and you show them that you're a real person, not by declaring all of your faults, but by really just going, oh, yeah, I felt that before, you know, or oh, I see where you're coming from, or, yeah, wow, he is really cute, you know, but just being a real person puts you in a place where they also know, oh, I want to hear more about what mom knows. I want to see more if mom's had this experience before, and they can connect with you a little bit better. Another vital way to communicate, and it's a nonverbal way for you, but creates a verbal way for them to communicate. I know a lot of parents wonder, how do I get my child to talk to me? And one of the main ways is to create a situation, like a mentor session or a date, or something like that, and then you be the listener. Don't be the talker a lot. Just ask really pointed questions and then don't say anything about it. Listening is so important. It's a way that you show that the other person has value. Whenever my children meet new friends, I always tell them, remember, if you want your friends to think that you're a good friend, you need to talk more about them than about yourself. You need to ask them questions and let them talk. Then they will have a wonderful time. So parent counseling sessions are also beautiful times for listening, and I think can always be utilized more. They take more time to pull someone aside and talk specifically about, you know, things and life and stuff, and to share your own feelings, and it just seems like, oh, it's got to be the perfect opportunity. But try to have those parent counseling sessions as part of your It's part of your family life. You just talk that way. That's the way you are. I know that with my children, that's what they absolutely adore. There was a time this spring when I went on a little hike, and it was just by my house. We live right by the mountain, and I went on a hike with my little son. I guess he was seven, barely seven. Anyway, and we talked about so many things. And we just walked and we talked about what was happening on the hike. We talked about the nature. We talked about, you know, tractors that we saw, whatever. We just talked about so many things. And he loved it so much, and so did I. It was so beautiful. He asked me the next day. In fact, he asked me when we got home, can we go on a hike just us tomorrow? And you know what? It wasn't because I shared some great wisdom with him. It was because I was there, and he was talking, and I was listening. And it was about bugs and trees and all kinds of things, and it is a vivid memory for him always. I'm sorry, I'm kind of emotional about it, but I realized at that time, why hadn't I done this before? You know, I mean, I go and do stuff with all my children all the time, but why have I never just taken this little guy on a hike, just me and him? I used to do that with my older one. Why haven't I done it with the youngers? Because logistically, it's a little bit more difficult, I think. But it just so happened that all the other ones were busy. So he came with me. And I vowed at that time I wasn't going to have that be the last time. That we were going to do this more often because it was valuable to him and to me. So create habits of talking and sharing. And maybe hiking is part of the habit you have to create. It is a beautiful thing when they will just come and tell you the exciting stuff in their lives. After the trek experience, my daughter came to me and she said, Mom, there were so many cute boys there. Let me tell you who was cute. So-and-so was cute, and so-and-so wasn't that cute, but I really had a fun time talking with him, and da-da-da-da, you know. And she just started talking about all the boys and about all the great feelings. And you know, when we were talking about all the boys, we were sitting out in the yard pulling weeds. Just her and I together in the shade, in the garden, pulling the weeds. And while we were pulling and working, she was telling me about all the boys. That doesn't mean she wanted advice. I gave her a teeny bit, but she just wanted to tell me. And I realized during that small moment, this is what it's about, to have a good relationship with your child. They can't wait to come and tell you these things. I very rarely ever shared those kinds of things with my parents. I felt like that was privileged, classified information, and they didn't need to be in the know. And they missed out. And I'm so happy that I'm not. So relationships need good, steady, deliberate communication. And parents can create those environments. So we've got example and nurturing and communication, the three things that we focused on today for helping us create stronger relationships with our children.